Thank you, Robert. Thank you. That was great. Thank you. Good evening. Are we working here sound-wise? There we go. Well, I've been here in Seattle now about 5 hours, and it's already started. The headaches. See, I flew in from Southern California. And there's something with your air here. It's so, what's the word? Clean! I'm with Woody Allen. I don't trust air I can't see, you know. So whenever I come to a place like Seattle, it takes me about a day to get acclimated because I go through hydrocarbon withdrawals, you know. So I got to have it now. I just kind of get the rental car and I turn it on and I go around the back and I clamp my lips around the exhaust pipe, take a few deep breaths, and I'm back to normal. So if I seem a little dizzy tonight, it's because I'm still working on the air thing here with you guys in Seattle. I'm actually here tonight because I have been deeply influenced by an ancient thinker. You've heard a bit about him already. His name is Jesus of Nazareth. And I think that Jesus had profound insight. I actually think he understood the world accurately as I began to read him now more than 30 years ago. To put it in kind of a simple way, I think he actually got it right. I think he figured it out. I think what he has to say speaks accurately about the way the world really is. And so when this began to dawn on me, I started to pay more and more attention to not only what he had to say, but those whom he trained to go out in the world and take his message, what they had to say as well. And so what I'd like to do this evening in my kickoff session as part of the series here is to reflect together with you on an issue that is a critical contemporary issue that is a pressing issue, actually. And I want to do it taking seriously the way Jesus viewed the world. So the backdrop of my reflections is the influence that Jesus has had on me. And I don't know where you are individually tonight, whether you're a follower of Jesus Christ. I suspect most of you are since we're in a church, and this is where followers of Jesus Christ gather a lot. But it doesn't mean that you are necessarily, and you may be a skeptic or not a follower or a tire kicker or something. That's okay. I'm glad you're here. And if you're not a follower, my promise to you tonight is I'm not here to convert you. That's not my goal. I actually have a smaller goal, a more modest one. What I'd like to do is to put a stone in your shoe. Okay, I want to say something tonight that gets you thinking and annoyed in a kind of a good way, you know, and you're hobbling out with that thing kind of gnawing at you a little bit, because I think Christianity is worth thinking about. I think the things that Jesus taught and the world view that he had is worth serious consideration, and so I'd like to put it in application a little bit this evening. About 10 years ago, I went into a chiropractor's office, which I think they ought to call chiropractors for obvious reasons. And I had a back problem, so a friend of mine who was a chiropractor, she was going to help me out. She had her assistant prepping me for the cracking. And I like asking people questions and trying to get the pulse a little bit, what people are thinking and where they're coming from, whatever. And so I put a question to the young lady who was getting me ready for this experience with the chiropractor, and the question was simply this. Do you think that morality is objective in some sense, or absolute maybe, or is it just relative? She said, what do you mean by morality? I thought, this is not a good start. All right, I thought I'd give her what we call a clear case example, all right? This is to kind of get the ball rolling. It's the one you get right, so you kind of get in the groove. It's like, you know, how long is the Hundred Years' War, you know, or who's buried in Grant's tomb, you know, that kind of thing. It's like the guy who said, I would have called 911, but I couldn't remember the number. You know, this is... So I said, is murder wrong? Taking an innocent human life without proper justification. She says, well, and I say, well, what? She says, well, I'm thinking, you know, don't rush me on this one kind of thing. And I'm thinking, what's to think about? This is the easy one, you know? And she says, well, I don't know. You know, it kind of depends on the circumstance. And I thought to myself, okay, this is not a clear case example. So I got to give her another one. I said, is it okay to torture babies for fun? Well, and then she said something that really tells the whole story. She said, I wouldn't want anyone to do that to my baby? Now, you think about that answer. Did I ask her what she would like to have done to her babies? No, I didn't ask her about her likes or dislikes at all. I wasn't asking about her. I was asking about a conduct, something that somebody did, this behavior called torturing babies for fun. I wanted to know whether that behavior was right or wrong, regardless of whether somebody wanted it to be done to their baby or not. I asked her at any time, at any point in history, under any circumstances, in any culture, could it possibly be defensible morally to torture a baby just for the pleasure it brings you? Long pause. Then finally she said, you know, I think people should be allowed to decide for themselves. I'm not making this up. This is what she said. Some things I make up, but this really happened. Now, I suspect, by the way, in her defense, that if I would have, if she would have wakened in the middle of the night because of a baby screaming next door whose parents were tormenting that child for the pleasure it brought them, she would have considered these people barbaric and then would have probably dialed 911 and had the police come over, which shows that sometimes people usually get it right when they're not thinking about it. And their moral intuitions rise to the surface because of the circumstance, and they can properly assess what's going on. But it also shows how difficult it was in this set of circumstances when we're simply having a conversation. When I'm asking her to stop and ponder and reflect for a moment on this moral question, it was so difficult for her, indeed impossible to say, that it was an objective moral harm to torture babies for fun. Now, what is going on here? I'll tell you what's going on. It's the power of an idea, and this idea has a name, and it's called relativism. Now, a lot of times when I tell people I've written a book on relativism, they say, well, what is that? And my response is, well, you already know what it is, but because you've been exposed to it so much, you just have never had it, in a sense, defined in so many words for you. So let me give you a characterization. Think of the difference between ice cream and insulin. With flavors, you choose what you like, what's true for you. Different strokes for different folks kind of thing. But when it comes to medicines, you don't choose what's true for you, that is what you like, what you prefer. You rather choose what's true, simply put, true for the thing. Moral relativism is the view that morality is more like ice cream than it is like insulin. That when it comes to moral questions, things of right or wrong, ethics, that it's not up to the individual. You don't invent it. You don't do what feels good for you. But moral relativism is the view that you do what is up to you, what you think is right, what feels good for you, as opposed to moral objectivism, which says that you don't invent morality, you discover it. So we have two views, moral relativism, pardon me for confusing you there a moment ago, which is the view that morality is just a matter of individual opinion, as opposed to the view of moral objectivism, which says that moral rules are not up to individual opinion, they're things that you discover, you don't make up. It's not according to your personal flavors. On the view of morality, everybody's morality is equal, should be respected, and it should be tolerated. You might remember what it says in the book of Judges, as the theme of the book, really. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. That's moral relativism. Now, I want you to think for just a second. Given that very quick definition, and I'm going to actually talk in much more detail tomorrow at one of the workshops about moral relativism. I'm actually going to give an argument against it. Today I want to talk about some of the oddities and how it influences our culture and influences you as an ambassador for Jesus Christ. What is it that holds our culture together? The thing that holds any culture together are shared values that are reflected in laws. So we have a set of values, what we think is right and wrong, good and proper, whatever. These are reflected in laws that either prohibit behavior or encourage good behavior. Okay? These laws then, therefore, are of necessity grounded in some notion of what is good. Aristotle put it this way, that all law rests upon a necessary foundation of morality. Now, he was just making an observation. He wasn't making that up. He was reflecting a view that the Bible takes for granted. That is, when a government exercises power through use of laws, that the power must be justified by its appeal to goodness. Now, you've heard people say that you can't legislate morality. The fact is that morality is the only thing you can legislate. That is, if there is not a moral reason for the exercise of power that you want to have with the law that you're using, then it's an illicit law. You must always have a moral foundation for that. Now, what happens if morality is the foundation of law, and law, a reflection of the values and the culture that keeps peace and holds the culture together, and it turns out that that foundation of morality is nothing in particular. It's whatever. A culture governed by relativism, then, denies that there is any morality that is objective and absolute, if you will, and drives and governs that culture. What do you have left? The only thing you have left, ladies and gentlemen, is just law. You have the raw exercise of power, and this shouldn't be surprising, then. Why, in a relativistic culture, which is the kind of culture we live in nowadays, do your own thing, basically. Who are you to say that I'm wrong? Who are you to push your morality on me? Well, when morality has exited the equation, all you have is law, and you shouldn't be surprised why people are then always taking each other to court. Well, it has an influence not only relativism, not only on our culture, but also on our Christianity, because it's going to be very, very difficult for you in a culture that is deeply relativistic, that has, at least as a conviction, that there are no objective moral principles that guard everybody, for you to communicate Christianity in a meaningful way. Because what's at the core of Christianity? Jason mentioned it last session, good news. Well, it's good news of a particular type, right? We believe, as Christians, we believe in a person whose name is what? Jesus, okay? Jesus is the what? Starts with an S. Savior. And what does he save us from? Also starts with an S. Sin, okay? What is sin, by the way? Isn't sin a violation of an objective moral principle of some sort? It's a violation of God's law? What if it turns out, though, that there are none of those things? There are no objective moral principles. Well, if there are no objective moral principles, there certainly aren't any violations of objective moral principles, are they? And if there's no violations of those things, there are no what? No sins. And if there's no sins, there's no need for a Savior. And if there's no need for a Savior, then there's no need for Jesus. Do you see in a culture and a church increasingly that is becoming more and more relativistic that the nature of who Jesus is then is going to change, and Jesus is going to cease being insulin, and he's going to be more and more like ice cream? He's going to be our flavor, not the one who rescues us from a deadly disease that we are all afflicted with, but somebody who could make our life better and give us the flavor that we want, that kind of thing. And of course, for those of you who understand biblical Christianity, once Jesus ceases to be insulin and becomes ice cream, then the game is up. No reason we should be here on Friday night. Now, I say this to point out the importance of this issue that I want to discuss just a little bit in one aspect today, and I'll talk about tomorrow in my workshop on relativism, because this is at the core of a lot of the conflict, either overt or covert, between Christians and a world system that is different from them. Because we can go out, even in a very friendly manner, and talk about Jesus, and if people are thinking relativistically, it's going to be very difficult for them to make sense of our message. Now, I want to do a couple of things in this session. I want to expose what I call the myth of moral neutrality. I want to also expose what I call the myth of tolerance. In fact, I want to show you how tolerance has become intolerance. I want to show you how to answer to the charge of intolerance if you receive that by people who object to your message. And then I want to show you how all of this relates to Jesus Christ, because it all kind of comes together in the end. In exposing the myth of moral neutrality, which is kind of at the heart of this, remember, with relativism, it's like you have your thing and they have their thing, and we're all neutral towards each other, and so therefore we're all tolerant, and we all live harmoniously in this tolerant atmosphere. And of course, the only the boogeyman in this one is when somebody stands up and says he thinks he knows what's right and wrong, and that you're wrong and he's right. Now we got a conflict. This is why Christians kind of stand out like a sore thumb in a relativistic culture. Well, I think there's a problem there. And I want to show you the problem by reading something that Faye Waddleton wrote. Now, Faye Waddleton is the former president of Planned Parenthood. You can imagine we probably don't have a lot in common philosophically, but I'm not reading this to ridicule, because I think this is really a superb characterization of a point of view that I want to critique, relativism. And it's always a good idea, if you want to critique a view, to get a really good characterization of it rather than misrepresenting it. So I'm going to read you what she wrote. In fact, this is so well written, you're going to think, boy, that sounds good. In fact, I don't think I'm supposed to agree with her, but I don't know how I could disagree with her without sounding foolish. It's that good. But there's a flaw, and I want you to listen carefully to see if you can find the flaw. Here's what she writes. Like most parents, I think that a sense of moral responsibility is one of the greatest gifts I can give my child. But teaching morality does not mean imposing my moral values on others. It means sharing wisdom and giving reasons for believing as I do, and then trusting others to think and judge for themselves. My parents' morals were deeply rooted in religious conviction, but tempered by tolerance, the essence of which is respect for other people's views. They taught me that reasonable people may differ on moral issues, and that fundamental respect for others is morality of the highest order. I have devoted my career, she writes, to ensuring a world in which my daughter Felicia can inherit that legacy. I hope the tolerance and respect I show her as a parent is reinforced by the work she sees me doing every day, fighting for the right of all individuals to make their own moral decisions about childbearing. 75 years ago, Margaret Sanger, and by the way, you know she's talking about abortion on demand there, okay? 75 years ago, Margaret Sanger founded Planned Parenthood to liberate individuals from the mighty engines of repression. As she wrote, the men and women of America are demanding that they be allowed to mold their lives not at the arbitrary command of church or state, but as their conscience and judgment may dictate. Then she closes, I am proud to continue that struggle to defend the rights of all people to their own beliefs. When others try to inflict their views on me, my daughter, or anyone else, that's not morality. It's tyranny. It's unfair, and it's un-American. Close quote. That's pretty good. I think that's very impressive. It sounds so sensible. It sounds so reasonable. It sounds so tolerant. But there's a fundamental flaw. First, let's ask this question. What is her view of morality? Implicit, actually explicit in what she's written. She says that we should trust others to think and judge for themselves, and that Americans should be allowed to mold their lives as their conscience and judgment may dictate. Is this more like insulin or more like ice cream when it comes to morality? It sounds to me more like ice cream, okay? In other words, she's relativistic. She promotes moral neutrality and non-interference. We should be morally neutral. If we are not neutral, then we are not tolerant to other people. So what's the flaw? Here's the flaw. Faye Waddleton errs in thinking that there is such a place as morally neutral ground. What I mean by that is kind of an island that you stand on in which you have your point of view, morally speaking. And you are committed to that view for yourself, but you are neutral with regards to other people on this view. So you keep it to yourself unless you're expressing your own autobiography, but you don't act as though your view applies to them. Because they're standing on their own islands of moral neutrality, and they have their own view, and right in between is this space, and this space has got a name. And that name is, what do you imagine? Tolerance, such that if you get off of your island of neutrality and you act as if your view is not neutral but applies to other people, then you have violated tolerance and you can be called lots of names like intolerant or narrow-minded or arrogant or bigoted, or you know the drill here on this. The problem is Faye Waddleton is not neutral. She talks neutrality. She promotes neutrality, but she's not neutral. It's obvious from what she said here. By the way, does she have the same neutral, non-interfering respect for other people who have different views than she does? Let's see. She wants to continue the struggle to defend the rights of all people to their own beliefs, except if your beliefs disagree with hers. Then your beliefs are not valid. They are, in her words, unfair un-American, and tyrannous. By the way, do you notice these are all moral judgments? For example, does Faye Waddleton show the same neutral respect for a person following her conscience by blocking an abortion clinic? No, she doesn't. Apparently, a woman can do whatever she wants with her own body except for throw it against the door of an abortion clinic. Now, she may have her reasons for this. I'm not taking on that issue right now. The point I'm making is that she's not neutral. That's the point that I'm making here. Here's another curiosity, by the way. Look at the first sentence. Like most parents, I think that a sense of moral responsibility is one of the greatest gifts I can give my child. But, listen, parents, but teaching morality doesn't mean imposing my moral values on others. Do we really expect that she says to little Felicia, now, daughter, dear, mommy believes in respect for elders and bedtimes and homework and those kinds of things, but far be it for me to ever force my moral viewpoint upon you. You do whatever you want. No, of course not. No parent would do that. I'm sure she wouldn't do that with little Felicia. She is going to train her in what she believes is morally right, but she can't do that if she's neutral. By the way, not only will Faye Waddleton impose her morality on her child, she will also impose it on you. How do I know that? Because she said so. Really? Where? Right here. I have devoted my career to ensure a world in which my daughter Felicia can inherit that legacy. What legacy is that? Her point of view. And what is she doing with her career to ensure that little Felicia inherits that legacy? She's a lobbyist. She shows up on Capitol Hill and talks with legislators trying to persuade them to pass laws that you must follow under threat of punishment even if you don't agree with the law. She will force you, if she can, to live according to her values. Case in point, now more than 10 years ago, May 1994, Congress passed a law making it a federal offense to block an abortion clinic. And Pamela Moraldo, who then was the president of Planned Parenthood, said this, and I heard it myself on the radio. Think about these words, ladies and gentlemen. She said, and I quote, "This law goes to show that no one can force their view on anyone else." Do you see that all laws force a view? This is a silly statement to make. I can understand her being happy about the law because it was on her side, but it's not neutral. And this is the point that I'm making. Please don't misunderstand me. Do I object to Faye Waddleton or Pamela Moraldo or anybody else lobbying for their point of view with Congress and trying to have their views heard or expressed in law? Absolutely not. This is the American way. This is the way we work in a representative republic. There's nothing wrong with that at all. My only point is it's not neutral. In fact, nobody is neutral in this discussion. And if all you take away from this 45 minutes or whatever you have with me this evening is this one thing, then this could hold you in good stead in helping you to see through some of the facades that a lot of other people don't realize they're putting up. They are putting up a facade of neutrality, but they're not neutral. They are taking a position. They are campaigning for what they think is right, and they think it is objectively so, and that you're wrong, but they just don't put it quite in those words so that they can't be called intolerant, but they can call you intolerant. Faye Waddleton is offering an ethic which sounds fair and tolerant, but it's a bankrupt moral system. It's called relativism, and it's not tolerant. It's very persuasive, but it's also misleading and fallacious. Now, this principle of no neutrality, that is, everybody has a point of view, and everybody thinks they're right, and almost all, as a generalization, are willing to impose their morality on you, even if you don't agree. This concept of no neutrality shows up in other areas as well, not just in morality, but also in religion. Where you have relativism applied to morality, it's called moral relativism. When relativism is applied to religion, it goes by a different name. Anybody know what it is? Pluralism. In other words, all roads lead to Rome. All roads lead to the top of the mountain. All religions are equally valid. 2.5 years ago, I was flown out to Toronto to do a show there on the national cable TV. It was called Test of Faith. And it was one of these shows. It wasn't a Christian show, but it was a religious show that was interactive by nature. And they had this big table. It was like a semicircle, like a donut cut in half. And so you have a small semicircle in the middle where there was a chair, and this chair was called the hot seat. And what they do is they fly in somebody with a weird religious point of view. They put them in the hot seat, and then one by one they'd bring out people, you know, other professionals that would kind of beat them up for an hour in front of national TV. Where do you think Mr. Coca was sitting? Mr. Coca was the weirdo in the hot seat. Now, what was my weird idea? My idea was that I rejected religious pluralism. I did not think that all religions were equally legitimate ways to God. Now, they had a Sikh, which is a religious order from India. The gentleman wore the turbans, a Sikh there from Toronto. He was an attorney. He was opposing me. They had a Hindu pastor, and then they had a liberal Christian from the United Church of Canada, a woman. That also sat across, plus the fourth one was the talk show host. Now, before the show started, I was talking with one of the cameramen or whatever in the back, you know, one of the guys who worked on the set. Nice guy, he was an atheist. And so we were making conversation. I said, let me just make a prediction about the way I think this conversation is going to go. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to offer an argument against religious pluralism. I think that view is false, and here are the particular reasons why I think it won't work. But they will ignore my argument, and they're going to start attacking me personally because I'm a Christian. Now, I'm not trying to be paranoid or anything about this. Like the guy said, you know, I wouldn't be so paranoid if everybody wasn't out to get me, you know, one of those kind of things. Look it, I've just seen this happen before, you know, so I know it's going to happen. We'll just see. Maybe not, but we'll see. So sure enough, I get called out. They get introduced. I'm sitting there with Valerie Pringle, who's the host, and she starts in asking questions. She wants me to lay out my case because I'm all by myself here, so I'm going to make the case. Now, I'm introduced as a Christian. People know there that I'm committed to following Jesus Christ, and usually there's a package of things that people assume go with that, and that's probably true with me too. What they didn't realize is I wasn't going to take a Christian stance in this debate. I said, Valerie, I could argue as a Christian that if Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation, then the other religions are false by natural elimination. But I'm not going to argue that way. I'm going to argue against religious pluralism the same way I'd argue if I were an atheist. Because I think an atheist would have to reject this too. Even if he acknowledged that there might be a true God as a possibility, religious pluralism would still be problematic. And here's why, I said. Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. Now, he either was the Messiah or he wasn't. Now, if he was the Messiah, the Christians are right and the Jews are wrong on that issue. And if he wasn't the Messiah, then the Christians are dead wrong and the Jews are right on that issue. But under no circumstance can they both be basically right. If God exists, he's either personal or he's not personal. If he's not personal, then the Hindus are right on that and the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians are wrong. If he is personal, then the Jews and Christians and Muslims are right on that and the Hindus are wrong. But under no circumstance can they both be correct. When you die, you either go to heaven or hell or go get reincarnated or go to astral worlds or you lie rotting in the grave, but you can't do them all at the same time. Now, listen, this is not cleverness on my part. These arguments have been around for a long time. I stole that from somebody else. But it makes sense, doesn't it? This is a good argument. I even offered them, I said, now there are two ways they can beat my argument, and here they are, but I don't think they're going to take them. And those two ways to beat my argument have their own problems. So I was prepared to deal with that if they wanted to bring it up. But I even offered some ways around my own argument. Okay, then here comes the Sikh. He's the first one up. She said, well, Mr. Singh, what do you think of Mr. Kokal's comments? And he goes, oh, he's very good. He's just fine. I think it's fine. If he thinks he won the lottery all himself, oh, good for him. Now, I got to be careful with my Sikh kind of accent because it starts sounding like a leprechaun. But he did. You know, he said, good for him if he thinks he won the lottery. What do you mean I won the lottery? Oh, if he's got the corner on the truth. Well, I never said I had the corner on the truth. I offered an argument that was unrelated to my personal convictions about the issue, by the way. He didn't go after the argument, did he? He started going after me. And, in fact, that's the way it happened, attacking me. And pretty soon there it comes out, Mr. Kokal's arrogant, Mr. Kokal's narrow-minded, Mr. Kokal's intolerant. He's the kind of people who starts wars, you know. All of a sudden, he's dumping the Crusades on top. course, I'm sitting there relaxed, and here's the Sikh is all animated, you know, and then the Hindu came out, and then it was the same thing, all of them, for 1 hour. You know, and I mentioned to him, basically they were saying this, Mr. Kokols, mean. Now, I hope you see that this is not an argument. But they had fulfilled my prophecy, hadn't they? And so I explained to him, look, maybe I'm mistaken. And I feel very comfortable saying that. A lot of Christians don't like it when I say that. But I'll just say, I could be mistaken. I'm not God. I'm not perfect. I don't know everything. Maybe I got it wrong. I think they got it wrong. Maybe I'm the one who got it wrong. So maybe I'm mistaken. Okay? But what I'd like you to do is deal with the reasons I offered so you can show me that I'm mistaken instead of just attacking me. I said, you know, it's kind of interesting. We started out talking about religious pluralism, and somehow we got off the topic, and now we're talking about Mr. Kokols' personality. You know, okay, let's admit, I'm mean. Okay, I'll just admit it, I'm mean. Now we all agree on that. Can we get back to this other thing? And notice how interesting it is, though, because all of these guys were the tolerant pluralist ones beating up on Mr. Kokol. What did I do wrong? But they never addressed the argument. In fact, at one point I said, maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe Christianity is false. But I tell you one thing. If you're right that I'm mistaken and Christianity is false, then it's not a legitimate way to God, is it? Therefore, it's not the case that all religions lead to God, is it? Therefore, if I'm wrong, then I'm right. Right? At least I'm right about what we're supposed to be talking about. They didn't get it. 1 whole hour, they didn't get that. The audience got it. I talked to members afterwards. They picked it up. The atheist in the back got it. In fact, he was so angry, he came up afterwards. You know, lights go up and the thing's all over. And he runs up to me and he's saying, what the heck was wrong with that Sikh? You know, he's using language appropriate to an atheist too, you know. He was upset. Here's the point here. Everybody believes that their view is true. That's why they believe it. If they didn't believe their view was true, they wouldn't believe their view, would they? They'd believe something else were true. It's not just the Christians who think they're right. Everybody thinks they're right in the things they believe. Now, they may not know they're right. They may not have good reasons to be right. But why is one side faulted for thinking they're correct when everybody thinks they're right? And you see, this is the move, the tactic, if you will, when I'm in conversations that I try to point out to people. Before I get to specifically how to deal with this, what I call the passive-aggressive tolerance trick, I just want to point out a little booklet we have on the back table there. One of the biggest offenses in that conversation was their understanding that I believed that Jesus was the only way of salvation. That really annoys people. Hey, I'm sympathetic. I can understand why that would annoy people. It annoys me too, to be honest with you. But guess what? I think Jesus is the one who said it, not me. I didn't make this up. So when people challenge me on this, I put the words back in Jesus' mouth where they belong. Okay, and that's why we put this little booklet together. Because I might quote a verse or two or three of Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. People want to dismiss it. Maybe I got one or two or three verses wrong. I did not get 100 verses wrong. This little booklet has 100 verses from the New Testament that implicitly or explicitly teach that Jesus is the only way of salvation. 9 lines of argument. So, I mean, maybe Jesus was wrong. Maybe he was mistaken, but make no mistake about the kind of claim he was making. And since I'm a follower of Jesus, I stand behind his claim. At some other time, I could talk about the reasons for that, although I think Jason spoke to that very well last hour. Let me show you how to deal with this passive-aggressive tolerance trick. Whenever anybody says that I'm intolerant, I always ask them this question. It's a tactic we use called the Columbo tactic. Remember Lieutenant Columbo? Remember that guy? I don't know. There's something about this thing that bothers me, you know. Do you mind if I ask you? You know how he does that. Okay, so we ask questions a lot. We teach people to do it. We have a whole course on tactics that help you to do that. One of the tactics is the Columbo tactic. So I ask this question. I say, what do you mean by that? They say I'm intolerant, right? So what do you mean by that? And I don't say it all offended, like, ugh. I want them to characterize for me why they are using that language regarding me. You're intolerant. I said, what do you mean by intolerant? I mean, it could mean a couple different things. I want to know what you mean. Well, you think you're right. You think you're right and everybody else is wrong. Like the Sikh said, you have the corner on the truth. My response to that is, yeah, I do, actually, think I am right. But I could be mistaken, I don't know. But let me ask you a question in return. The things that you disagree with me on, you have your own beliefs. Do you think your beliefs are right or wrong? Now, what did we just learn a few moments ago? That everyone believes his beliefs are true. By the way, you already knew that. You just didn't have it put in so many words. Well, the person's, what are they going to say? Yeah, I got all these beliefs and they're all wrong. No, they've got to say, yeah, well, I think I'm right. Now, sometimes they'll say, well, I'm right for me. You know that move. I say, well, it sounds suspiciously like you think you're right for me too, or otherwise, why are you talking to me right now? Sounds like you're correcting me, right? Okay. So, well, they got to say, well, I think I'm right too. Now, here's my follow-up question. And this is Columbo. Remember, I don't know, there's something about this thing bothers me. Why is it when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant or arrogant or narrow-minded or, you know, name your poison. But when you think you're right, you're just right. What am I missing here? Now, this is not a rhetorical question. I want an answer for them because what I'm trying to show is that they've taken the coward's way out. I'm not going to call them a coward. That wouldn't be charitable. But I want them to show that this is not helpful. They're just calling names. And it would be better for neither of us to call each other names, but rather to spend our energies trying to figure out who's actually right. Right? This is important stuff. And so whenever anybody asks you this or calls you that name, you walk them through that and help them to see that you should be talking about the issue and not your personality. Now, there's a reason that people fall into this. They are not trying to trick you. They are socialized to say this. They don't realize what they're saying. It sounds right to them because so many other people do the very same thing, and Christians get caught flat-footed. Okay? The reason is because the definition of tolerance has changed in the last 30 years, and this is very important. Frank Beckwith and I, my co-author on the Relativism book, we talk about this in the book, but let me give you a thumbnail sketch of this. I'll do so by telling you what happened. I had a conversation with high school students in Des Moines, Iowa. It was in January about 3 years ago. It was really cold in Des Moines, a lot of snow on the ground, and I was speaking at the University of Iowa. There were names, and this was close by. I had some free time. They said, can you talk to this high school group? That was a Christian high school. I won't tell you the denomination, but it was a Christian high school, and I was supposed to speak to their seniors in their religion class, and there was like 12 of them in there, you know. Now, I'll just tell you a secret. I don't like talking to high school kids, personally. And if you're high schoolers here, I don't mean anything, you know, by this, but look, it's like, for me, it's like talking to a painting. You know, they just sit there. You know, and I could tell a joke to high school groups, and they would have adults falling off the, you know, floor, their chairs, and the kids are sitting there like, are you going to laugh now? Are you going to... We're not going to laugh. So here they were. You know, they were sit up, and it was a long table. And I'm in front of this classroom, and they're all on the opposite side. So it looked like the Last Supper, right? And so I wanted to talk about the tolerance thing because I wanted to give them something that they could sink their teeth into and take home with them. And so I started talking. Finally, we get this, what's this thing that's really valuable in our culture nowadays? Okay, tolerance. All right, tolerance, got that. What is tolerance? They all agreed that it was really important. What is that? They got to hear the... This was painful. So finally, we get a definition on the board, and I wrote it up. And the definition was, all views are equally valid. Okay, and that's in the ballpark. If you think you're right and somebody else is wrong, you're intolerant. If you say that all views are equally right or equally valid, then you're tolerant, right? That's kind of the way it works. So I thought, okay, we're making progress here. Well, then I wrote another sentence. Underneath the definition of tolerance, all views are equally valid, I wrote this sentence. Jesus is Messiah. Jews who reject him are wrong. Ooh, them's fighting words, right? And boy, all of a sudden the painting comes alive, you know, because I just broken a rule. Now, remember, this is a Christian high school. And there was a young lady over on the side that was just coming out of her seat like this. You can't say that. That's intolerant. And then she says, how would you like it if somebody told you you were wrong? Think about it. You see what I'm talking about? This happens all the time. Now you see something you might not have seen before. You know, this is all of a sudden she's doing this stuff, and you're seeing what's wrong with it. I said, it doesn't bother me a bit. Why should it? And just a little excursus here. Notice how this view of tolerance, what it's doing to our children. Our kids feel they have a divine right to be ticked off because somebody thinks they're mistaken. Oh, you know, what if... How would you like it if somebody told you you were wrong? Doesn't bother me a bit. I'm a grown-up. So I turned around to the board, and I looked at the board, and I said, okay, we got the definition of tolerance. We got this other thing that you don't like. I circled the first definition. All views are equally valid. And I said, is that a view? Is that a view that all views are equally valid? Is that a view? Okay, yeah, they got it. I went to the second statement. Jesus is the Messiah, and Jews who reject him are wrong. And I said, is that a view? This took a little more time. Finally, yeah, I guess it is. I said, that's interesting, isn't it? Tolerance is the view that all views are equally valid, and then we have another view that says Jesus is the Messiah and Jews who reject him are wrong. Based on our definition of tolerance, what must we say about the second view? It is just as what? Valid as any other view. Therefore, for the young lady who's objecting to me having said that, she is stating that my view is invalid. Therefore, she is guilty of what? Intolerance on her definition. So all views are equally valid, including all the views that don't hold that all views are equally valid. They're just as valid. In other words, are all views are equally valid and not equally valid at the same time. See a problem here? Doo-doo. It says contradiction time, right? This can't work, ladies and gentlemen. This is a distorted sense of tolerance that is self-refuting. It is incoherent. It is contradictory. It is self-referentially absurd. It's nuts. And I told him, here's where you guys went wrong. And then I wrote down something. There's a couple of ways to write this down, but I erased the board, and I said, here is the classic definition of tolerance. The way Peter Kreft puts it is, be, and I wrote this down for him, he says, be egalitarian about people. Egalitarian, they had a hard time with that word. It means treat people equally, as equally valuable. But be elitist about ideas. Now, they knew what an elitist was. An elitist is a snob. Somebody who thinks they're better than somebody else. Yeah, that's the way you should be about ideas. You should treat people equally, not ideas. You should be elitist about ideas, though. Why should you treat some ideas as better than others? Because they are. Some are good, some are bad, some are smart, some are stupid. Some are wonderful, some are dangerous. Some are absolute poison. And we should have the liberty to figure out which is which. Which liberty is infringed when people settle for name-calling rather than doing careful thinking about the tough issues? You see, the classical sense of tolerance is just the opposite of the way people are practicing it now. Now they say all ideas are equally valid. And if you think they aren't, they can abuse you as a human being. The old classical view of tolerance, it was rooted in a Christian view of human beings as being valuable in themselves. Tolerance is good, but not the new twisted kind. It's the old kind. Now, tomorrow when I talk about relativism, I'm going to give you an actual argument against relativism. We're here. I've just talked about one of the problems, the abuse of tolerance. And I'm going to also explain to you why, in spite of the fact that relativism is so popular, nobody actually believes this anymore. Nobody's really a relativist. And I'll show you how that's a key to dealing with the problem of relativism in the culture. Let me just close with this illustration. When I gave this, I've given this talk at a lot of campuses. In fact, I had a debate on it here at University of Washington a couple years ago. But 2 years ago, I gave this talk on a Friday night at Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. And it was an absolutely packed house. In fact, they have overflow rooms. It was really a wonderful night. I was a little nervous when I went into it because the first night I was talking about moral relativism. That was a Friday night. And Saturday night, I talked about religious relativism. It was entitled, Why Jesus is the Only Way. Can you imagine that at Berkeley? But I really had a great time with him, especially after laying out the problems with relativism, much more than I've done here this evening. And then I said at the end, if relativism is false, then some form of moral absolutism or objectivism must be true. There are principles out there that inveigh upon us that are true moral principles, whether we like it or not. And I think you know this already, I said to them. I said, because there's something, this has explanatory power. Because there's something that I know about every single person in this room that you know about yourself, but you try to keep it from other people, but you haven't kept it from me. What is that? I said, you have a bad self-image. How do I know that? Because everybody does. It's the human condition. We look down inside of ourselves and we are aware that there's something desperately wrong. Now, we try to hide it from other people. We can't hide it from ourselves. In the quietness of our own heart, we reflect upon ourselves and we see something ugly and broken and twisted, and that ugly, broken, twisted thing is moral. There is something evil down there lurking, and we can't get away from that. And we have a feeling about that. And that feeling has a name in the English language. And what do you think the word is that we use to describe the pain of our own immorality, our brokenness? It's called guilt. You all feel it, I told them. Now, did you ever ask yourself the question, why do you feel guilty? Now, I guess you could say, well, maybe society creates it. I guess that's open for discussion. Maybe, you know, you got Jewish guilt and Catholic guilt, and, you know, and there was a lot of Asians in the audience. So I said, you got Asian guilt. I just threw that in. Wow, they all started laughing. So I guess there's a lot of Asian guilt going around. I don't know. I said, well, maybe that's in the running, but how about this? Maybe, just think about this. This is the stone in your shoe. Just think about this. Maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. Is that a possibility? Is that in the running? Well, I'll tell you one thing. If we are guilty, the answer to guilt is not denial. That's relativism. The answer to guilt is forgiveness. And this, I told them, is where Jesus comes in. Now, since I was going to be talking about Jesus the next night, I said, I'll explain that tomorrow when you come back. Which is great because it filled the hall again, you know. But it set the stage. But the point that I'm making here is we start out with where the people are at, this problem of tolerance and culture, and they think we're the bad guys. We think about it a little bit, and we realize this is just a sidestepping of the real issue. This is just kind of petty name-calling. It's because they're confused in what real tolerance is. And what real tolerance ought to involve is engaging each other vigorously, showing respect for the individual in the process, but not a respect that is protectionism of the ideas, especially if the ideas are dangerous and injurious. And so with a respectful attitude, we can battle, in a sense, back and forth on the things that matter and hopefully come to a proper conclusion. And see, this is the method of Stand to Reason. This is why we're here. Our goal is to build ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Now, ambassadors need three qualities. They need to know a few things, knowledge. They need to use that knowledge well, wisdom, and a tactical wisdom. And they also have to have a character that commends the message. We call that a Stand to Reason. Knowledge is an accurately informed mind. Wisdom is an artful method. And character is an attractive manner. We want sharing your faith to be more like diplomacy than D-Day, quite frankly. And we think this was the style of the New Testament by and large. Sometimes there's a line drawn in the sand, but by and large, he tried to avoid that. Communicate in a powerful way. Now, we have a plan to help do this in your life. One of them is our website. Jot this down. Stand to Reason. The acronym is what? What's an acronym? STR. For those of you in the dark on that, STR.org. That's easy, right? We get hundreds of thousands of visitors every single month to our website because there are hundreds of things you can download on every single thing imaginable. In fact, our new newsletter that's supposed to be mailed out in May, we've already got it posted. It's a double issue on the Da Vinci Code, which Gary will talk about next segment. But this is something we have. It's timely. It's there to help you on everything you can imagine, from philosophy to apologetics to ethics to theology. It's all there. STR.org. That's the first thing. The second thing, you received something when you came in. Most of you did. It's a little bunch of Stand to Reason propaganda and a little card like this. If you have one of these, pull it out right now. Let me explain what this is. And if you don't have one, you can get one probably at our table in the back. It's two parts to this, a blue part and a white part. If you crimp it, there's a little perf there. You can tear it apart. The blue part is for you. This is a thumbnail sketch of the Columbo tactic. And the questions, the basic questions that we use and how to employ them, put it in your Bible or in your purse or your pocket or whatever. That's for you. This is for me. It's a little white card where you can tell me where you live. If you fill this out and give us to us at the table, we will send you free training material every single month. Free. One of the things is our Solid Ground newsletter. You have copies of that, some of you. You see what that's like. The double issue coming out May 1st is on the Da Vinci Code. My promise to you in our newsletter is you'll never find pictures of our staff at bake sales, okay? It's not that kind of newsletter. It's meant to be a hard-hitting tool that will help you to defend your faith and to be intelligent as a Christian, as a good ambassador. So we'll send that to you. That's a bi-monthly. On the alternating months, you'll get a one-page letter from me that's more pastoral in tone, but will help you to be a better ambassador. Now, we have a table of stuff in the back. You can take a look at it later, but I just want to draw your attention to these three. It's actually a set. Okay, this is called the ABCs or the Ambassador Basic Curriculum. We put our best up in 15 CDs. Every CD has the full set of training notes, my lecture notes, for every single talk. You see an example of some of the notes in the back there. It's $25 a piece, $70 for the set, but it's the best thing that we can give you, $5 per CD, that will help train you to be a better ambassador. There's after you go through the material, it's a course, so we'll graduate. You send you a certificate, and you get a little pin like this that says you're an STR ambassador. Our goal is not to sell product. Our goal is to build warriors. Where's my man? Warriors for Jesus Christ. And I thank you for the time that we spent together this evening, and I look forward to tomorrow doing more training as warriors in Christ. Thank you very much.